Since the Grenfell Tower fire in June 2017, fire safety conversations have understandably been dominated by the topic of cladding. However, whilst important, that is not the only issue that landlords and tenants need to bear in mind when protecting their buildings against the risk of fire. I'm speaking to Ben Robinson, partner in real estate litigation at Pennington's Manches Cooper, about the importance of a comprehensive approach to fire safety. But to deal with that important issue first, Ben, let's begin with cladding. What is the current position on ACM cladding replacement?
Hi, thanks, Jess, and thanks for having me on the podcast.
Pleasure.
It's kind of a good time, actually, because the housing communities and local government have just published their report on cladding progress, and that came out on the 12th of June. Mm-hmm. And I think if it was a school report, it would probably say must do better. It's a short and punchy, I'd say, report on progress, and opens with it being 1,000 days since Grenfell. Mm-hmm. And deals with the funding, which I know we're going to speak about later in the podcast, but essentially draws a few lines in the sand to say, with ACM cladding, this needs to get sorted by the tail end of next year, and for non-ACM cladding, that needs to be sorted by June 22. So they're really starting to, I think, put clear and visible deadlines up. Mm-hmm. And I think that reflects perhaps, I wouldn't say a lack of progress on all parties, because there's been work that's been getting on, but I think it just is indicative of ramping up the pressure. It's also got some useful information just on the number of properties suspected to have remedial issues, and also recognises that they're complicated issues. You've got different materials used in different combinations. So it does acknowledge that the struggles that the sector's faced, but is saying, come on, let's get on with it.
You mentioned funding, and I imagine one fundamental question for buildings that do require cladding replacement is, at the end of the day, who foots the bill? So who is typically bearing this responsibility, and is there government funding available?
Absolutely. Well, I think certainly it's a fundamental question. It's also the most frequent question. but I'll take each point in turn, if I may, Jess.
And
focusing briefly on the responsibility aspect, I mean, I think everyone's agreed that the group that's least responsible for the defects are the leaseholders. And I think as time has gone on, the question that you've just asked has come to be recognised that it's ultimately going to be determined by the lease, but unfortunately, in the vast majority of cases, that lease is likely to put liability on the leaseholders. Through the service charge, that's quite right. And you do occasionally see some provisions that perhaps will take items such as latent defects outside of the service charge liability, but it's not always a silver bullet for leaseholders. And as I say, they're not that frequent in leases. So I'm afraid the default position is that it's likely to be the leaseholders. But I did want to, I think it's worth just exploring who else might be, on the hook, as it were. And I think it's really important that time is taken to consider whether the original project team, the builders, developers, etc., can offer up a route to recovery away from the leaseholders. And we'll
in many cases, we'll be talking about quite significant sums of money, wouldn't we?
Indeed. I mean, I think the latest report put the average remedial cost at somewhere per building at somewhere below 2 million. I think it was 1.7 or so, but significant costs. And as I say, the latent defect point is a difficult one. That's to say that there's a defect that wasn't known to the parties or the landlord and tenant in this scenario, but of course into the mix of issues is the fact that non-compliance with current requirements doesn't necessarily equate to non-compliance at the time of construction. So was it defective at the time it was built? Question mark. I think is the initial, obviously a lot of work has to go into addressing that. And again, you've got multiple claims, multiple defects, multiple parties, and being a lawyer, unfortunately, we know that's complicated, risky, and costly. So I think it's awful to say, they're not wildly helpful, but it's not straightforward. But it's important to think through the issues, I think, is the key point. And turning on to funding that you asked, it's the government's certainly put a lot of money into this. I think the recent report that was out on the 12th of June says it's likely to need to be more, perhaps three times as much more. But we had the fund last year for ACM cladding, which is aluminium composite cladding. That's shut down now for the time being, or that period's closed, and remains to be seen whether it will reopen. We've got, in March of this year, we had $1 billion put aside for the removal of other unsafe cladding systems, so that non-ACM cladding systems. And touching on the point we said earlier, that's aimed squarely at protecting residential leaseholders from paying in a service charge. And we've recently had information about the registration process from the government, and that's currently open, and it's important to know that that closes down on the 31st of July. So starting gun's been fired, so to speak, to get your registration in. And this is a fund that applies for buildings over 18 metres, which is this categorisation that is often kind of bandied around, which I think is possibly a useful signposting exercise, but is not without its own difficulties. it doesn't cover work that's already in hand. That's work that's been remedial work that's been committed to, and et cetera. So you might be sitting there thinking, we've been quite organised and got on with this, but we've missed out on the fund, and I think there'd be some justification for that. And it's not going to cover waking watch or remediation of other fire safety issues, again, something I know we're going to touch on. So there is funding available. It's important that, and it's quite clear that that's for the benefit of leaseholders. It's for the building owners to take up and register. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, but rest assured that the expectation is that people registering for the fund are going to have to look for other routes of recovery as well, be that insurance, developers that I mentioned earlier, or other contracting parties. So I don't think it's going to be a straightforward handout in that sense.
Obviously, a lot of the focus has been on cladding works on residential towers. Are there any specific issues raised in purely commercial or mixed commercial and residential premises?
Yes, well, thank you. It's a good question, and I think it's fair to say that the focus has rightly been on residential buildings, but of course we do spend an awful lot of time in commercial buildings, so it's certainly worth dealing with. Commercial buildings fall under the remit of the Regulatory Reform Fire Safety Order 2005, which I've said completeness there, but doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, so I'm just going to call those the regulations. But those regulations are aimed at commercial premises and duties of employers. It's worth adding, and I should add, that the regulations do apply to communal parts of residential properties, which is why there's a bit of dovetailing between commercial and residential processes. And I'll briefly also say that the Fire Safety Bill, if it's enacted, should hopefully deal with a couple of the issues in relation to the regulations and residential buildings, because it's thrown up a whole separate chain of inquiries about what's a common part in residential buildings, because traditional definitions didn't deal with structure and cladding. And so hopefully that's going to be cleared up, but that would probably be the subject of an entirely separate podcast, Jess, to be honest. But so sticking back to commercial premises, in practice, If you're a landlord or a tenant of the commercial premises, you've got the regulations. You will ultimately have an expert who will have to come in and say whether or not the building complies with the regulations, the fire safety regulations. It will then be, it will need to be ascertained who's responsible for dealing with those issues. That question might need to be asked before you get the expert in, but ultimately, someone's going to be responsible for compliance with the regulations. Again, we have to look at the lease to answer that question, and that will do with maintenance, repair and control. And then they will have to enact the works. And so in many senses, the analysis that you have to go through isn't wildly different. I think ultimately, though, people are probably less concerned about commercial premises and who has to pay. But it is important, I think, to recognise that, you know, these are all buildings that the public have access to, hotels, fitness centres, etc. And I think in broad terms, it's just important that commercial landlords and tenants need to take notice of the fire safety narrative, and ultimately the unsafe cladding will need to be removed. I think the reality also is that there is a relationship of mixed-use premises, and that's because buildings aren't kind of binary in the sense of residential or commercial these days. You have varying layouts, different interests, shared responsibilities. So in answer to the question of fire safety or issues in relation to commercial and residential premises taken as a mixed use, I think all I can really say is that it's complicated, but ultimately what the expert panel, the government, what everyone wants to happen is for cooperation between those commercial interests and those residential interests. That's entrenched in those regulations I mentioned in Article 22. Basically, make sure that you're cooperating, disclosing information, try to help each other in a holistic approach to make sure that these buildings are safe. I should add, the fund I mentioned about non-ACM cladding that's open will apply to mixed-use residential and commercial premises. But I think, largely speaking, the issues are similar, Jeff, but because of the different interests, you just have to cooperate and make sure that you're working together in a kind of more overview manner to make sure that the building, however it's formed, is safe.
Indeed, and in order to do so, there are other issues in cladding to consider, as we mentioned. So what, prior to Grenfell, were the most pressing fire safety issues for landlords and tenants?
I think before cladding unfortunately came into the public consciousness, predominantly fire safety claims that came across my desk were to do with compartmentalisation and fire stopping. That's to say the fireproofing of areas within a building to make sure that if a fire does start that it can't easily travel from one unit to another. And I think those claims were largely driven by things such as defective workmanship. So it would be that something came to light, someone took down a ceiling and realised that there was a complete absence of fire stopping around risers or in the above the communal doors, and those types of issues. And whilst the costs I mentioned earlier in the podcast about external cladding are seen to be high, because clearly you've got scaffolding, you've got time constraints, it's complicated work, internal works, unfortunately, are also substantial, because you have a finished plastered room, and as soon as you start taking aspects down, the reinstatement and redecoration works alone can be quite complicated. And so I'd say that prior to Grenfell, there was a lot of issues with fire safety, but focused on bad workmanship, lack of operating and maintenance documentation, and trying to just track down how was a building built, which you think is a simple question, you know, has it been built as it was planned? But unfortunately, as we're now seeing, that simple question doesn't have a simple answer. I mean, there are other fire safety issues, again, that have always been on the radar and are hiding in plain sight, such as balconies and smoke control systems, fire doors, and other issues. But I think that the campaign group Manchester Gladiators, one of their representatives said, if there's problems on the outside, you can bet your bottom dollar there are problems on the inside. And I'm afraid I'd echo those sentiments.
Is there a danger that, with the obvious focus being put on cladding, that these more traditional issues have fallen off the radar?
I think that's it's certainly true to say that there has seemed to be this signposting of cladding 18 metres residential buildings, and I think it's an interesting discussion we're having about those other issues that perhaps haven't had as much headlines. But it's interesting, because what you have to do to ensure that a building is safe is to step back and take an overview of all of the infrastructure, and all of those aspects that are interplaying with each other. And you can focus on the cladding, but having safe cladding without considering other issues is not going to provide a comprehensive strategy. So you're right, it needs to be a focused strategy, a fire risk assessment that's going to take into consideration all those points we've discussed and come out with a risk assessment of whether it's a building is safe or not, or what categorization of risk it would be in. And I think that it's a case of, if you've got cladding that's been signed off, that's great, but we need to check on the other issues, and we just need to keep the momentum up to make sure that we've tackled this problem that has obviously had horrific consequences. So I think it hasn't had the lion's share of articles and notes and guidance notes, etc., but it does very much need to be kept in mind.
Obviously, the paramount concern in this is saving lives, but one other reason it is very important for buildings to be fire safe and certified as fire safe is so that leaseholders can deal with their properties in the usual way and are able to buy and sell and get mortgages on them. I believe the RACS introduced the EWS1 External Wall Fire Review Scheme last year, a form that shows that a building complies with all current guidance on fire safety, which is intended to satisfy mortgage lenders about properties they're asked to lend on. How does that scheme operate in practice?
Yes, well, it's as you say, it was introduced, I think, December last year, and it was designed to kind of unclog the issues that have been discovered or been encountered in selling leasehold properties and these zero valuations on leasehold properties. And put together, the form itself is a relatively straightforward form in the context of what you can see in this area. And I again think everyone has agreed that it was a sensible idea. I think in practice, it has had its issues. And I think, again, that's addressed in this 12th of June report very well. And in one sense, I'm not going to repeat that in huge amounts of detail because it's been put very well in that report. But I think it's fair to say that one of the issues from our end as lawyers is that it's the scheme itself doesn't have any statutory footing. And so the difficulty you do have is that there's no obligation on anyone to procure a completed form. So in other words, whilst one would hope that building owners, for all the issues we've been discussing, are cracking on with their review of cladding and their fire risk assessments, this form itself, which is, let's say, geared for the lenders, for the property market, came about quite late in the day. And it's very difficult for a leaseholder to say, I need this form, please sign it. I mean, putting aside for the time being the practical difficulties of finding an expert, what are their timings, how much is it going to cost, are they prepared to sign it off, and these are all points that have been raised in that recent report. Putting aside those issues, fundamentally, you can't sit there, I'm afraid, as a leaseholder and say, under this obligation or under this clause in my lease, you are supposed to give me this form to enable me to sell my property. That doesn't exist. And so there's deadlock in the analysis and the expert advice, but there's also no teeth there really for leaseholders to move it forward themselves. They can't instruct intrusive surveys of the common parts or the structure. And so it has rather ground to a halt. And as I say, my focus for the purpose of this podcast was just the fact that it's very difficult as a leaseholder to say, give me my form. And it's only in the rarest of cases that I think they could do so. The scheme works, I think, on the basis of cooperation again, and this holistic approach to building management and fire safety. And whilst I think everyone's working towards that, there are a lot of people, there's a lot of different interests at play, and people moving to different time frames, and that's, I think, where the clash has happened. And there are, even on the leaseholder side, you may be a leaseholder wanting this form but can't get it. You may be a leaseholder who doesn't want to sell their property and doesn't want to incur any costs in relation to these reports, unless you absolutely have to and don't want to see it on the service charge bill. So as I say, there's a lot of lot of different parties pulling in different individuals, and that's before you get to actually getting a hold of one of these forms or working out whether in fact you ask for the form, and that makes it become apparent that the building's non-compliant, and therefore you've got all the other issues. So it's just, again, the risk of sounding like a broken record, just a lot of issues and a lot of complicated factors at play.
Another issue in the residential arena is right to manage companies, many of whom likely didn't foresee wide-scale fire safety improvements in their futures when they looked to take over management of their buildings. How are RTMs coping?
I think if you get many different forms of RTMs, different sizes and different degrees of sophistication, but it's true to say that taking over the management of your building is a very attractive idea for many people, being able to control what's happening and control that expenditure. But of course, with this new revisiting of fire safety and obligations, it's come with a lot more scrutiny, a lot more pressure, and as we know, a lot more cost, unfortunately. Now, if the RTM is posed with addressing those issues, you have very large landlords and managers who are struggling to deal with the fire safety aspects. You have landlords and managers with good infrastructure contacts and with deep pockets who are, as I say, struggling to move it along. So if you are in a group of individuals who run your building, trying to grapple with those, be it on a part-time basis or however it's dealt with, is incredibly difficult. Obviously wrapped into that, as if you're a director of an RTM, there are penalties for failure to comply, and you have responsibilities that can't be delegated. So, I think if you have hands-on directors who know what they're doing, you stand a decent chance. But I think it's fair to say that it's something that was probably never envisaged when the decision was taken to take over the management. What we were talking about earlier in the podcast of complex litigation against developers, whether you want to even contemplate taking that route. RTMs obviously will have access and issues, leaseholders who aren't resident, trying to get hold of them to gauge what they need to do or what they want to do, and enforcement of demands and recovery of funds. So it's a really complicated area again, and not something that, as I say, as a management company or a right to manage company, perhaps you were prepared for or want. And it's one thing to arrange for the estate management aspects and put in place contracts for cleaning, guttering and various other aspects, all of which need to be done within a building or a development. But as I say, I think it's widely recognised that this is a different kettle of fish and far more difficult. And I think those right to manage companies will be leaning on freeholders and other parties to try and work out what to do. It's not a problem that could be probably addressed by any party alone. And again, it just brings back in that concept of working together to ensure that fire safety and purpose built blocks is there. And I think that's probably something to take away, that it's that working together to try and to get over this hump. But it's very difficult. So lots of RTM companies are going to be struggling, whether they can survive in the long term in terms of getting the money in. They've got scaffolding up. Can they meet the continuing costs, depending on how the service charge structure is in the lease, and can they get money in advance? All of these issues, but it's going to be problematic, and we may well see a lot of these companies who get struck off for non-compliance or simply go insolvent. Let's hope that's not the case, but you can see with the sums involved that it could be a possibility, and then we'd have to look at who takes over and picks up the pieces.
And complicating matters still further, as it has in pretty much all walks of life, is the COVID-19 crisis. As we speak, the country is slowly coming out of lockdown, but how have the last 3 months affected the carrying out of much needed fire safety works? And what has the impact been of commercial premises standing empty for so long?
I think at the risk of rolling out a generic answer about the impact of coronavirus, I think it's certainly in my view, it seemed that there was some initial uncertainty in the construction sector in the immediate aftermath of the government's lockdown. What came fairly quickly thereafter was an announcement that all non-critical health and safety work should stop. So in other words, critical health and safety work could continue. And towards the end of March, that was, I think, clarified as essential maintenance, and cladding certainly fell in line with that, but all under the umbrella of, can that work take place in line with NHS guidelines, etc. So I think as far as the government will be concerned, it's a case of there was a little bump for whilst we sorted out exactly what critical health and safety work is or was. But I think they're going to say, look, there's no excuses. At worst, it was X days or weeks. And anyone seeking to rely on that for the on COVID-19 for delays is not likely to get very far. I mean, there may be some finger pointing going on and groans about it being a very fluid situation and no one knew what was going on. But ultimately, they're going to say you need to get on with it. It was always important. I think on a practical level, it clearly has delayed works. If assuming, as I was saying initially, that those works are and always were to continue during lockdown, practically, of course, getting into buildings, undertaking intrusive surveys, and undertaking that work at socially distanced with those measures in place is problematic and will have slowed down the rate of progress. And I think we're seeing that that some residents obviously don't want work put in their property. You've got Waking Watch in other buildings strolling around undertaking important work, but again, generally in the communal areas and people have to pass by. So it has all fed into this chronology since Grenfell of how quickly can we do it. It's come at an awful time for so many reasons, but also for the reason that it would have delayed some of that work. I think the second side of your question, of course, you do have lots of empty commercial premises, and there have been reports of those being occupied by squatters. Mm. And there have been court practice directions on possession proceedings. And I think, again, initially there was a bit of uncertainty as to whether that applied to squatting proceedings, but that was clarified, and I think we're seeing those go through now. So it has posed a number of novel problems for property lawyers, and practically, I think, for those on the ground trying to undertake the remedial works.
Well, there is obviously so much to discuss in this very important area. I'm sure we could keep you for a couple of hours if we had the time available. But thank you, Ben, for joining me to address these headline points.
Thank you very much, Jess. No, happy to come back on if there are any of those that you want to drill into a bit more detail on. But I hope that was an interesting overview anyway.
It certainly was, and I'm sure our listeners will agree. Thanks, Ben. It certainly was, and I'm sure our listeners will agree. Thanks, Ben.